Welcome back to Homegrown. I'm Janine Wishy.
I am Bob Hill.
And today on the show, we have high
expectations,
high met. Gardening.
Fully met, actually.
Fully met, indeed, yes.
Well, it's true. We're going to high rise in New York. We're going to a bluff above the Ohio River in Louisville, the Glenview.
John Karloftis, he specializes in small space gardening, a name that may sound familiar to you because he is a native of Kentucky and extremely proud of it. But he, 20 years or so ago, he moved to New York City and started a rooftop gardening
empire.
It's pretty cool. Nice guy. So we'll be talking to John today. He's going to be in Lexington for an event coming up here. So we took this opportunity to hook up with them, see what's going on. And we're going to go visit. It's our run of garden tours, right, Bob?
Two down and 22 to go.
That's right. This week we're visiting Steve Humphrey and Sue Grafton, their garden at Lincliff, an old estate, been around since the early 1900s. I think the original garden was designed by Frederick Law Olmsted's nephew.
Yeah.
And, it seems seen some garden incarnations since then. But we're going to see what Steve Humphrey has done with it.
Including a maze. Mm-hmm. He's creating a maze, very English-oriented places. We'll see. It's got a sunken garden, a lot of statuary, a lot of boxwoods. And he's creating a maze. It takes 3 or 4 years, of course, to put those things together. But very interesting guy. His background is very academic, philosophy of physics and science and those kind of things. But he also loves to garden, and he and Sue are restoring this place to its former grandeur and well on the way. It's just a very interesting place.
I look forward to the visit, and we hope that you'll stay with us as well. All right, Bob, what's going on in your garden?
My rocks have been moved.
Oh, they have?
I feel like this is the way you do about your chickens.
Humongous rocks?
Humongous rocks. They weigh several thousand pounds a piece.
Uh-huh.
And I got, I'm always moving rocks around my place, and I have to give a shout-out to a guy named Mark Furnish at Furnish Towing up in Henryville.
So you use tow truck services.
You cannot beat them. Huh. They're a whole lot cheaper than cranes.
Uh-huh.
And Mark is such a great guy, and, I paid him, of course, a reasonable fee, but he's a good guy. But he came in and babied my rocks, got his tow truck, and picked them up, and weaved his way through my 5 acres of precious trees and shrubs.
You couldn't use a crane in there anyway, because there's too much stuff in the way.
Who could afford a crane?
Well, even if you could, you know what I'm saying.
But he gets this big tow truck, he picks up my rocks, and he backs around and puts them in place, sets them down very carefully, and he did all three of them. It's right behind the kitchen window.
So you get to enjoy it inside.
Because I am totally fed up with that garden behind the kitchen window.
Uh-huh.
And as happens with gardeners, out with the old,
in with the new. And the rocks are the foundation.
They are indeed. And it's just going to be so neat. I'm excited about it.
Excellent.
Particularly spring plants, ephemerals. Sure. I want to stick in there for spring.
Right. That's a good idea.
So I'm redoing my rock place. Mm-hmm. How about the Wishy Estate? What's up?
I wanted to give you a cicada update because you were so lucky this year that you don't have, you never get cicadas, it seems.
We did last time.
You did in 04?
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't know that.
No, we did.
And I didn't. But I have
there
them this year and you don't. And pretty, and
justice.
People, we get countless emails, you all, about the cicada thing. Some people are extremely freaked out about it. Some people think it's cool. It runs the gamut for sure.
Intellectually.
But the frenzy should be over for most of us by now. It looks like we'll have a little bit of damage, but not anything too bad. We did net trees that were very, some of those young dogwoods in our little dogwood grove, stuff that you could actually net. So that kept the females off the trees, from egg laying on the little twigs. But, the rest of the stuff you just can't protect. So I just wanted to sort of remind people, if you do start to see some flagging tips, basically the tips of trees that have been slit open, and if they flag, fall over, die, break, go ahead and do some strategic pruning where you can, and that'll help clean, plants up. And also don't worry too much, because most plants will be able to recover just fine. And if you think about it, 4 years ago in 2004, do you remember the damage that occurred then?
Yes.
And now you can't really tell at all, right?
Right.
So it's sort of the cycle of nature, not necessarily a reason for it. Although I do have to say that my chickens have literally gorged themselves on cicadas. You let them out in the morning and they race off as fast as they can to underneath certain trees where they
get
know they
all
can
you
get.
Yeehaw!
It is great. It's very funny.
A cicada stampede.
Very funny. So it should be finishing up here soon, folks. So don't worry too much.
Speaking of a stampede of insects, so to speak, the Good old Blackacre Nature Preserve is having a butterfly walk on Sunday, June 29th at 2 p.m. Mm-hmm. Naturalist Alan Nations will lead an interpretive tour of the paths. Yeah, he is a good guy, and the wildflowers and woodlands and so forth, and he'll talk about butterflies and how they interact with us
and everything
else. Thank
God
they do.
And Blackacre's a really nice place to visit, you know, really back to nature sort of experience. And they have got good programs out there. It's in the J-Town area.
Yeah, it's easy on the gas, too.
It's real close to me, in fact. You don't have to drive to Montana. Yeah, no kidding.
Right.
Okay, so that's Sunday, June 29th, Bob. And then let's see. An event that sort of dovetails into our next guest. There is a old estate in Versailles, Kentucky area called Welcome Hall.
Huh.
And they're hosting a Blue Ribbon Day garden lecture event. It's going to be an all-day event. It takes place, as I said, June 25th. It's from 9 a.m. to 3 p.m. John Karloftis will be there, Roger Dennis, and then Jennifer Bartley. We've interviewed Jennifer Bartley with her kitchen garden book, remember?
Right, exactly.
She's pretty cool. You do have to purchase tickets, so you'll want to check out our website for contact information. But it is being hosted by the Little Garden Club of Woodford County, and is, again, at Welcome Hall, which is in Versailles. So you might want to check that out.
And speaking of John Karloftis, he's almost ready to talk to us.
He is almost ready to talk to us. Indeed. I hope he's ready to talk to us, right? Yeah, John Karloftis is joining us now. He's a professional gardener, a designer, and a writer, and he heralds from Rockcastle County, Kentucky. But he did make a name for himself among the terrace gardens in New York City. Today, he gardens and lectures here and there and is a contributing editor for Garden Design Magazine and a regional writer for Country Gardens. He's also written two books and sells garden-related items through his company, Rockcastle River Trading Company. John, welcome to Homegrown, and thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Sure. You are originally from Rockcastle County, Kentucky. And, you know, I know that's something that a lot of folks in Kentucky are proud of when they talk about John Karloftis and host you. But can you explain how your experiences in Rockcastle and growing up there are kind of reflected in what you do today? And, you know, I mean, really your choice to become a professional gardener.
Well, you know, we grew up in a very beautiful place. My family's been there 54 years, and it's just beautiful in its natural beauty,
mm-hmm.
and it just has affected how I look at life. You know, how what I try to do in New York and urban gardens, I try to bring nature in to these spaces that need it.
Right. Was it easy for you to bring that sort of beauty to places that you know felt, you know, people that hadn't experienced what you had experienced growing up? I mean, were people extremely receptive to it? Was it kind of a new idea? You know, what were the attitudes?
I will say that's the great thing about, you know, people, and, you know, to have these thoughts of what New York is like, and it is kind of, it can be rough, and it's hard, and it's tough, and it's all those things. But when you bring something in that's natural, they're very appreciative, and it certainly makes it, anything you do, when you have someone that responds to mm-hmm. to it in a positive way, it makes it all better. You know, it makes you want to do it.
Oh, yeah. Now, John, did you have horticulture in mind when you attended the University of Kentucky?
No, I had a business communications degree. It was just a degree to, you know, kind of get through.
Right.
Get through it. I was in an agriculture fraternity.
I know the feeling, man. Believe me. Totally.
And then when I got out, I decided, oh, my gosh, I better, you know, you live once. You better do something that you love. And I've always gardened my whole life and been outside. And I thought, you know, I'm going to go back. And I took horticulture classes and all, you know, I didn't get a horticulture degree. I just took all the classes that I wanted to take, art history, all these things. But I absolutely fell in love with plants, mm-hmm. horticulture.
Yeah, our son today took the courses he liked and couldn't figure out why it wasn't a degree at the end of it. What's wrong with this picture?
I think you both turned down all right, though, after
well,
all.
Well, how did you get from Lexington, Kentucky to Lexington Avenue? Was it a deliberate step?
Well, actually, I came up here. A friend of mine had moved up to New York and said, come up for the summer and see what it's like. And I was never one of those people that wanted to, you know, those kids at school that want to move to New York. That was never anything I ever wanted to do because I didn't want to be in a city. But I moved up here just for the summer and started a little business, and I made cards up that said, John Karloftis, Rooftop Garden Designer,
right.
And I'd never been on a roof. But I knew my plants, and it took off because people responded to what I was doing, and I just really enjoyed, I loved it.
Well, do you remember the first job you sold and what you did and how you felt about that?
Oh, yeah. I was with her for 16 years.
Maybe don't want to talk about it.
Just, I'll never forget. She had this very famous art collection, she and her husband, and of contemporary art. And she brought me inside the house, and you looked out. You know, on these rooftops, they're not on the very, very top. The house is up there, the apartment is up there, and then the terrace goes around it.
Okay.
So I looked out, and she said, I want you to take the artwork and take it outdoors, feel it, you know, take it outdoors, the same feeling. And it was such a new idea for me. I was like, wow, this is great. That she's trying to do something that's, you know, that's going to connect the inside with the outside. So it just was, it all started with that. And that's how, kind of how I design. I look at interior, and that tells you pretty much what people like. And I try to take it outdoors.
Then how difficult, you make your mind up, you have a design, where do you find the materials, the plants and so forth?
Well, I live out here in Bucks County, Pennsylvania, because of that. There's great nurseries out here. You know, Philadelphia is an hour away.
Right.
And great, great history of nurseries out here. So there's lots of places. I'm the best customer for about three nurseries.
Yeah.
So, John, are there, like, any fundamental guiding principles when it comes to gardening on terraces? I mean, most of all, those spaces are going to be containers, right?
Yes.
You know, which is sort of a different ball game than planting stuff out in the garden, you know, in terms of wind and pollution and exposure and that sort of thing. What are some of the considerations?
Well, weight is the main issue with these buildings. Whoever owns the penthouse, you have to have all these things approved, and I find out from the engineer to find out how much weight the roof can hold per square foot. And we make everything lightweight containers. The drainage is you can't use gravel. We use styrofoam pellets or recycled aluminum cans. And then you use a lightweight soil mixture like, you know, Pro-Mix or Miracle-Gro. And then you use container-grown plants that are lightweight, too.
Okay.
But you have to tie it all down because it's all so lightweight.
Right.
Do you ever get the urge to bring in 7 cubic yards of good old dirt and grow tomatoes or something up there, some big garden?
Well, I do grow almost in all the gardens I have, and I've done about 100 gardens, I guess, at least. I've created about 100 gardens or more, and I try to always, you know, I work for a lot of movie stars, and you know what? We're all the same. They just want to go out and grab a tomato and grab some basil, and people just want to go out and live off the land.
So you're not just doing rooftop terrace gardens. You also do traditional gardens, if you will, on ground. Is that right?
Yes.
Yeah. But there is one rooftop garden I'd like to talk about, and that's one that's local here in Louisville. You've worked with the folks at 21C Hotel to create somewhat of a kitchen garden, a very useful garden for them at the hotel on top of their roof. Can you talk about that a bit?
Yes, we planted the garden, the original garden, you know, the one that's the kind of the beauty garden, 2 years ago, I guess, 3 years ago. And then they were talking to me about Michael Paley, the chef, wanted to, you know, to grow a few little things that he could run up there and get it. And of course, I took it and went on with it. And we have all these. We have, I guess, 10 whiskey barrels, recycled whiskey barrels that are filled with herbs. And then we have all these little troughs from Southern States that we grow in all kinds of vegetables, spinach and lettuces and tomatoes, and so there he's going to be able to go up there and get a lot of garnish and just a lot of living off the land.
Yeah, well, John, in all your gardens, I assume you lay these things out, you design them, then you have to go back to Bucks County, and do you worry about the maintenance and upkeep? Who does that after you're gone?
Well, down in Kentucky, I introduced them to someone that I know from University of Kentucky that just graduated a couple years ago, and he's got a great little business, and I just pass them on to him. And then here in the city, in New York, I have a company that we do the maintenance. We do all the plantings all seasons, and I have three men in New York City, and they live there, and they do the maintenance.
Is it difficult to haul the stuff up elevators? I just have this mental image of carrying plants and buckets and containers and sprayers up 34 floors in an elevator and doing the work.
It is. It's a struggle from the word go. You go in, and I drive in, and people are very aggressive drivers, and then you get in and you wait in line, and then they give you a ticket for $115 if you double park,
Man.
And then you have to worry about always worry about the truck and blocking someone in or getting a ticket, and then you unload it and you carry it through the service elevator, and because each building is different, everything has to be carried by hand. They're not, it's not OSHA standards. they're not
right.
this wonderful ramp. They're these little rabbit's warrens. And all has to be hand carried up through there.
Rooftop gardens to down on ground gardens. Can you talk about some of the other projects you've worked on? Certainly in Kentucky, but some other places as well, but places that folks around here can perhaps visit and see some of your work?
Well, one of the gardens that I've just got photographs today from is University of Cumberland, where all my brothers and sisters and my mother attended college. And I didn't go there, but I got roped into it, and and I certainly have been so happy with how that my family restored this garden that was built in the teens. And it had slowly turned into, how gardens, they kind of go away and get surrounded by parking lots and everything else, and it became this mud pit. And we restored it several years ago, and it is just beautiful. Mm-hmm. And that's open to the public.
Where's that located?
In Williamsburg, Kentucky.
Okay.
And then at the Healy Whitney Museum in Lexington, I donated a garden there. They had a tennis court, and we made it into sort of a formal garden that they can use for parties, for weddings, and they can put a tent on it, and they can move the containers around. Very interesting.
Hmm. Well, can you give us a sense, say, your biggest, one of your more big and most grand gardens? How many pots are involved? What kind of plants do you put where? How long does it take to do the job?
A big, big job takes about a week and a half, 2 weeks to build, start to finish. And then we have the water system person come in after us, which is all important up on a roof because it's hot and windy, dries out very quickly. But, there's gardens I've done that has, maybe 75 big, large planters.
Wow.
And lots of 30 trees, 40 trees.
Well, list some of the flowers and trees you use quite a bit.
I love river birch. Because I love them. I grew up with them on the river.
Right.
And red buds do very well on a roof. Crab apples do very well. I love smoke bush. Mm-hmm. They're beautiful up there. Lilacs. Any sort of fruit tree does real well, too.
Mm-hmm. So, just the mere fact that they're in a container, does that kind of have a bonsai effect, John?
It does.
In terms of keeping them small?
It does.
Okay.
The first thing they do, is With they'll put that root system out the first year, and it'll tell it how big it can get.
Mm-hmm.
Because of that bonsai effect, the trees are very beautifully shaped. There's something about a container-grown tree that they get this great, great shape.
And what are some of the perennials you use quite a bit with success? I assume grasses are among them.
Grasses are popular. I love Siberian irises. I mean, to me, you can't have a garden without an iris leaf in there, that sword-shaped leaf.
Sure.
Even have peonies on the roof. Hostas do very well in containers. Big ears, the stockies.
Mm-hmm.
And roses do great in containers.
Mm-hmm. So are you predominantly using perennial plants and woody plants then? Something that, to a certain degree, once it's done, there may be some maintenance, pruning, cutting back, but, not replanting as such like you would annual containers.
Right. Well, we add annuals and into the pot. The pots are very intense. There'll be a tree in it underplanted with a shrub, with a perennial, and then you'll pop in a little annual every year to mm-hmm. give you some color to take it through the season.
And then the containers themselves are surely part of the process. How do you decide and where do you get them?
Well, there's lots of different styles, and I just it's easy to design, I think, if you I work with the person, and that's the part of it. I love the people,
right.
And that's, I mean, the garden I love, but it's the people that make it so good. And I try to think, you know, I see what they like inside, and I'll, some are ultra-modern, very sleek, and then others are much more traditional, fiberglass, plastics, there's beautiful plastics now,
mm-hmm.
and there's, I get a lot from this company in England, and they do beautiful, beautiful containers.
So you also, you mentioned you send in an irrigation team, water team, after the fact. So I guess that's a fundamental part as well. Fertilization. But, John, you know, so many people complain about pest issues, either insect or disease. Is it different up on a roof? I mean, are you going to find less insect activity because it is windy? It's there's not as much.
The only thing that we have a problem with in New York, pretty much, are aphids.
Okay.
That's about it. And you'll get scale every once in a while. That's uh-huh. stuff I hate. But, you know, on the whole, there's not a lot of the same insects problems that you have on the ground.
Are they just because they can't get up that far, do you
right.
think? Well, so what about birds?
Birds, they love it. I have a garden where there's a duck that comes back every year in the same container, and she lays her eggs there every year, and they hatch out on this penthouse on Park Avenue.
That's great, and obviously the owner likes it too, huh?
Yes, well, there's not any duck soup. Let's hope they don't.
You ever get hummingbirds up there?
Yes, it's that is such a treat to see. You don't see them that often, but especially if you're next to the park on Fifth Avenue or Central Park West, where it's close to the big Central Park.
Mm-hmm.
Now, a lot of this is in one of your books, right? You've captured, talked about this process and where you're from and so forth?
Yes, and that's my book, First to Garden, and it tells about how I grew up in Kentucky and photographs of my family's place and lots of different styles of gardens. And the second one is called Beyond the Windowsill, and it's working with interior plants and something I never cared for growing up, never liked interior plants, and then, you know, it gets cold, long winters up here, and I started, like, looking at them, thinking, you know, I need something green in here, and people need something living in every room, I feel, and I started getting into it. Now I love them.
Yeah. So your family still has a family farm, home, place, and gardens down in Livingston, Kentucky?
Yes.
Do you still visit down there quite often?
Oh, gosh, yeah.
Yeah.
Talk to them 3 times a day.
is that garden open to folks?
It is. It's open. We're closed on Sundays, but we're open to the public 6 days a week. And we have, it's just very kind of simple. We have a koi pond. It's just really beautiful and natural. But my favorite garden of the whole thing down there is the vegetable and herb garden. It's originally I created this garden for the New York Flower Show, and then after it was done, we moved everything down to Kentucky.
Yeah, great. And your mom's down there running everything. You also have a business.
Yes.
Can you tell us about that, the trading company?
Yep, Rockcastle River Trading Company. We sell beautiful containers, of course, mm-hmm. and lots of garden-inspired things for the home, soaps, herbal mm-hmm. soaps, sheets, anything that pertains to the pretty much to the garden and has a kind of a garden feel.
Mm-hmm.
It's just people love going down there. My mother, she is a great, great woman, and people just love to come and see it, bring their lunch.
And she takes all the credit for your success, I would assume.
Oh, listen, she said, let's see, I'm the owner, but she's the boss.
That's right.
<That works.
laughs> Sounds good. John, thank you so much for your time.
Thank
we
you.
Appreciate it, and we
thank
look forward
you.
To your visit.
Well, thank you, and I enjoy listening to you when I've been in Louisville working, and I just happened to turn the radio on, and I really enjoyed it. This was, I guess, about 6 months ago.
All right. Thanks a lot, John.
Thank you.
Uh-huh. John Karloftis is a professional gardener, designer, and writer. His work can be seen on the Terrace Gardens of New York, at Ashland, on the rooftop of 21C, and at his family home in Livingston, Kentucky, among many other places. John will be in Versailles on June 25th for Welcome Hall's Blue Ribbon Day Garden Lecture event. Of course, for more information on that event, on John Karloftis, and everything else we've talked about today, is on our website at WFPL.org.
Coming up next, we visit Lynn Cliff, the garden of Steve Humphrey and Sue Grafton. You're listening to Homegrown on 89.3 WFPL. Well, Miss Wishy, we are sitting here on a veranda, porch, you name it, about 8 inches deep and wonderfully soft furniture.
In my world, I call this a veranda.
Veranda, okay. It's a big old porch where I come from, baby. But anyway you call it, it's a wonderful place. It's called Lynn Cliff. We're going to talk to Steve Humphrey and his wife, author Sue Grafton. They've lived at Lynn Cliff on the bluff above the Ohio River for about 8 years. Steve teaches the philosophy of quantum mechanics, the philosophy of space and time, the philosophy of physics and symbolic logic at the University of Louisville, as well as UC Santa Barbara. But today, we're going to talk to him about the physical joy of getting dirt under his fingernails. Steve, welcome to Homegrown.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
We were talking earlier, and you said you just always had some sort of garden in your life. Kind of take us through how you went from that to this.
Well, the first house that I owned with my wife, Sue, was in Columbus, Ohio. And we had a little tiny container garden in the backyard. It was all bricked in. It was in German Village up in Columbus. And I couldn't resist the opportunity to plant some vegetables and some herbs and mint. I remember we planted some Brussels sprouts. I hate Brussels sprouts. But we planted some Brussels sprouts, and we harvested them immediately when they were ripe, threw them on a steamer, and ate them with butter and salt, and they were fabulous. They were absolutely fantastic. Now, it didn't change my mind about Brussels sprouts. But if I were to grow them again, I would eat them again. But ever since then, I've just been always hidden to have some kind of garden. Started out with vegetable gardens, but then got into roses, got into the whole hybrid tea and the cutting them and long stems and all that craziness. And then, you know, every house I've always had something going on in terms of landscape architecture, or landscape design, or landscaping.
But this house here at Lynn Cliff, I think, has allowed you or presented you with a palette that perhaps you haven't had before. You can tell us. So can you sort of fill our, because it's just a beautiful place. It is very reminiscent of English estate gardens. I mean, architecturally, the house as well. So can you give us a little background on the history of the house, the property, and what kind of incarnations it's seen over the years before you got here?
Well, it was built originally in 1912 for the Belknap family, and Mr. Belknap died before it was completed, and I don't believe his wife ever lived here in the house after he died. Their bachelor son, I think, took possession of it, and then they lived here for a while. They rented it to the Bingham family in 1917, and it was here that Mary Lily Keenan Flagler Bingham met her untimely demise.
That's right. There's a little...
Little mysterious stuff in there, and that still is actually. And then there was a family, there was an interim family there that I keep forgetting. Then the Crawfords lived here, and then the Geens bought it after that. And Mary Jo Geens was a very avid gardener, and she did a lot of stuff on the property. Now, the Crawfords put in the Brian Fleming stuff, the fountain and the boxwood garden, but Mrs. Geens was the one who really took everything to new heights. I've talked to people that lived here on the property, worked here on the property. They said it took a crew of about a dozen people to maintain the property when Mrs. Geens owned it. She built the greenhouses. She's the one that went up into all the tall trees and put lightning rods or lightning arresters in them. And you can still see them dangling out of certain trees. But she was the one that really enjoyed the property most until I came along.
Well, talk about that a little bit. What kind of goals did you have in mind when you bought this place, to recreate what it was or add your touch to it or some combination of both?
Yeah, a combination of both. When I first saw the house, it was clear that the bones, the skeletal structure of the gardens were intact, and there was lots of opportunities to just resurrect what had been here. And so for the first 4 or 5 years I was here, that's what I did. was I worked on just trying to get it back to what it must have looked like. Then after that, I started to say, okay, now it's time to put my particular imprint on the property. And so that's when I started adding things like the Knott Garden, like the LA, like the maze, you know, those fun things.
So fundamentally, we've got a couple of different significant components to the garden. Sunken garden, where you do have your Knott Garden, some other features as well. So can you take us through the different areas, and then we'll talk about the fun stuff that you have recently added and are planning on expanding on?
Well, let me say one thing first before we get to that. You mentioned English manor gardens or English country gardens, and that really was my inspiration. I've been to England and Scotland a number of times, and I've always been fascinated by the gardens. And so while Sue wants to do cultural things, I want to go see gardens. So I've been to Hyde Park. I've been to Hampton Court a couple times. There's a place up in Scotland on the west coast called Killeen Castle. And they've got a fabulous garden. I've got lots of ideas from there. And so coming here, I looked at this as an opportunity to reproduce those wonderful English gardens that I've always been so fond of. And some people say, oh, it's just like a French garden. I go, No, it's an English garden. I've never seen a French garden. It's an English garden. But I started here with the front of the house, and we took everything out of the front. Weeds had been growing up. Weeds were as tall as trees. We took a lot of stuff out and did some design work and planted the front of the house up. The greenhouse in the back of the house had been allowed to get really out of hand. There were asbestos trays with weeds growing up through the glass that had broken the glass out. It was a total mess. And I thought, I'm going to get that thing back up and running. That was one of my first projects. Then we moved into the boxwood garden, and we started cutting the boxwoods. The boxwoods had been allowed to get so big that you could barely walk through the garden. So we had to do that in stages about 6 months apart and let them grow back. We're still operating on that. The fountain was in terrible shape. It was filled with dirt. All the upper courses and stuff were just filled with silt. It was good dirt, but it was still dirt. And so the first stage was just going around and trying to just sort of get back to the bones, to get the dirt. You know, it's like when you do a painting, if you're trying to restore a painting, you know, you got to get all the smudge and stuff off. You got to get all the grunge off and just see what you have. And that's what I did at first, was just to kind of get things back, get all the weeds, get all the stuff that shouldn't have been here and shouldn't have been allowed to grow. I put that, get that out of here. Then I was able to start taking positive steps.
Two of the super fun touches, I think, that you're adding here at Lincliff is a maze. And then we saw the plans. Nothing's in the ground yet, but Bob and I were fortunate enough to see the plans for another sort of sunken garden.
Well, it's a parterre garden. It's parterres and Knott gardens are similar creations, but the parterre garden's a little different. It tends to be flatter, and you don't have the knots, per se. And if you do have knots, they'll be flat on the ground made out of gravel or something. A little more French, exactly. Hence the word parterre as opposed to knot. So that's what I'm thinking about there, and I've got a combination of things that I want to do. I'd like to have a couple of small trees, like dwarf lilac trees as sort of focal points. Or maybe we were just at the Greenbrier, and they have some wonderful weeping mulberries there, Morris alba pendula. Right. And those things can stay fairly small, and they're gorgeous if they're kept up. They're even pretty in the wintertime. So I was thinking to have a couple of sort of focal points in there, but everything else to be fairly flat.
One of the neat things about the parterre garden is you're combining your philosophy of quantum mechanics, philosophy of space and time, philosophy of physics, and symbolic logic into the parterre garden. Talk about that.
Well, I decided I've always wanted to do this, and this is the first opportunity I've had. The design I'm going to put in the ground in the form of gravel is going to have some of the classic physical and mathematical constants, things like E, which is the base for the natural logarithms, I, which is square root of minus 1, which is used extensively in quantum mechanics, and it's an essential part of quantum mechanics, is any wave theory, H, which is Planck's constant, pi, of course, which is the, yeah. And then right now I've got the symbol of 1, which is because 1 is an interesting number. But I'm also thinking about infinity, the sign for infinity as well. And so that's just a way of leaving my mark of my interests here in the garden, but not in a way that's really in your face. It's not something you're really going to see unless you're in a helicopter.
Or teach quantum physics.
Yeah. Well, yeah.
All right. You also have something. You, as we walked around the garden, you told us sort of the trials and tribulations of some of the grand schemes that you have. And you have a beautiful hornbeam allay. Talk about some of the epiphanies you had sort of after the fact.
Well, I've seen a number of hornbeam LAs, and you can also make pleached LAs out of lime, and there's a couple other things you can do. But I was thinking about the hornbeam LAs, and hornbeams are what are called anosculate. And if you take hornbeams and you bruise them or injure them and then take the bruised parts and tape them together, they'll actually grow together and become a single plant. Pleaching was used back before the Middle Ages, I mean back 2,000, 3,000 years ago, to form elevated living structures. And by doing that, they could make it more secure and the foundation stronger. But it would get them up off the ground, away from the bears and bugs and things like that, and keep them safe. So I think the act or the art of pleaching is very, very, very old. But I'd seen pleached LAs, and LAs are, of course, wonderful anyway. They lead either to an object of interest or to a view or to infinity or something like that. So I wanted one. And I said, okay, how are we going to do this? And then I looked around, I talked to some people, and I found a source for hornbeams. And they're Carpinus betulus, the European hornbeam. But the ones I got were Carpinus betulus fustigata, which is an upright growing habit. And later I realized that was probably a mistake, but those are the only ones I could get. I also planted them. I planted 90 of them. There's 45 on each side. They're planted 3 feet apart. It's 135 feet long. That LA. And I planted them 3 feet apart because I was in a hurry and I'm impatient. But now I'm thinking I should have probably planted them 6 feet apart because in not too many years, they're going to basically grow together. Oh, well.
Our listeners are going to wonder about this. Does Sue out here with a shovel too, or she just lean out the window and say, go get them, Steve?
She didn't even lean out the window. She just says, oh, you're out of the house? Good. And she calls me and says, is it lunchtime yet? Where are you on the property? Is it time to eat lunch? But well, she doesn't participate much. She does appreciate it, and she loves it. And when guests come over and I show them around, she likes to come, and she exclaims, just like anybody else does, who's never seen the garden, because she hasn't seen it for a while.
Now, what do you got tucked away in the back of your evil mind for beyond the parterre?
Well, let me talk about the maize first, because we haven't talked about the maize, okay? We put the maize in last fall. Now, every boy wants a maize. You know, that's just a fact of the world. And I've seen some mazes, especially at Hampton Court and in Europe, and I've always thought that'd be really a keen idea. So I started noodling around. I've got a little landscape design software, and I started noodling around with some designs for a maze. And then I started looking around for, well, what am I going to make the maze of? My first thought was a mixture of three different kinds of plants, all evergreens. And I was thinking of taxus, I was thinking of arborvitae, maybe junipers. The theory being that if there was a blight on any one of them, I wouldn't lose the whole maze. I'd only lose a third of the maze, okay? And most of the mazes you see are actually a combination of different kinds of plant material. But when it came time to actually find the plant material, it was difficult to find stuff that was of the right size, the right height, the right kind, the right uniformity. So I finally decided to just use the Blue Point junipers. And I was able to get some little three and a half footers. We planted that maize. There's 550 of them in the maize. We planted that maize in about 2.5 days. I had four people. And we were using my dingo with an auger. And I had laid it out with paint marks on the ground. We just came down, and I'd dig a hole. Somebody would come behind me, take a plant out of its pot, put it in the hole, somebody come behind them, fill it in, assembling it, off we went. But it was a lot of fun designing it. And sometimes for me, design is the most interesting part. And then to see it after I've designed it on paper and to see it in the ground, it's really fun.
But you're clearly a hands-on guy, too. You're out here digging holes and making messes and everybody like everybody else.
Oh, yeah, I take sometimes 3 showers a day. Because I'm out there getting dirty a lot.
But you do have folks that help you. So tell us about your staff, and I'm sure they're not really considered your staff.
Well, they consider me their staff, actually. Well, I've got Jeff Baldwin, who's been working here for about 6 or 7 years, actually, and he lives on the property. And he and I are in charge of the big projects, the construction things. So if we're planting trees or planting bushes, or if we're, like today, we had the tank sprayer, we're spraying for nutsedge. But those kinds of mechanical things, we're real good at. And Jeff is the king of Roundup. So if something has to be killed, he straps on his Roundup on his backpack sprayer, and he spends a day killing stuff. Erica Bumba is the pretty committee. So she's in charge of planting and fertilizing. So Jeff kills it, Erica grows it. And then I'm basically design and oversight.
Right.
So, we work together very well. We're all on the same team. We all have the same sort of investment in the property. when I came back this time, I knew we were going to be on the Kilgore Garden Tour in May. Right. And so I got back March 29th, and I said, okay, guys, for the next 6 weeks, no holidays, no days off, we're working. Mm-hmm. And so that's what we did. And by the time the tour came out, the place looked spectacular. Absolutely. And so I rewarded them with various kinds of incentives, which I tend to do, you know, for jobs well done. And so, you know, it's a lot of fun.
And Mother Nature was certainly agreeable this year.
Oh, yes. This has been a spectacular spring, just wonderful spring for growing things and starting things and making everything look great.
It's certainly beautiful. You've all done a great job, inspiring in terms of creativity, but also all the hard work. Thanks for letting us come out.
Well, thank you very much for coming out. It's always a pleasure to see you guys, and I wish you well.
Steve Humphrey, with the encouragement of his wife, Sue, and two great staffers, is redoing Lyncliffe, a wonderful estate high above the Ohio River, just east of downtown Louisville. For more information on Steve or photos of Lyncliffe, visit the Homegrown page at WFPL.org.
Coming up next, we have a new Latin word of the week and listeners' questions. You're listening to Homegrown on 89.3 WFPL.
How many kinds of sweet flowers grow in an English country garden? I'll tell you now of some that I know, and those I miss you'll surely pardon. Daffodil, heartsease, and phlox, meadowsweet, and lady smocks, gentian, lupin, and tall hollyhocks, roses, foxgloves, snowdrops, forget-me-nots, in an English country garden.
In an English country garden.
How many insects come here and go through our English country garden? I'll tell you now of some that I know, and those I miss you'll surely pardon. Fireflies, moss and bees, spiders climbing in the trees, butterflies that sway on the cool gentle breeze. There are snakes, ants that sting, and creeping things in an English country garden.
In an English country garden.
All right, welcome back to Homegrown. This is Janine Wishy with Bob Hill.
And I've got a couple questions that will enable you to use the word neem.
Again? No.
Neem. I like to say neem.
Neem.
But it drives people nuts.
Probably.
What is it about neem? I'll stop. Miss Wishy, question from Meg Sullivan.
All right.
Are you ready for this?
That name rings a bell. Do we know Meg?
Meggie O'Sullivan.
I don't know.
From County Waterford and Ballymacarclass.
What does Meg have
She's got a yard with a rose bush. Mm-hmm. She's an inexperienced gardener. Her internet research leads me to believe that the rose bush is infected with rose slugs. Mm-hmm. Many of the leaves are brown and appear to be skeletonized, although I can't see any slugs on the leaves. How do I treat this problem? Is it possible to do so without the use of insecticide?
Okay. Neem.
Neem.
I'm sorry, I don't mean to sound like a broken record, but if it works and it's not so chemically, and plus she says she doesn't really want to use hardcore chemical,
exactly.
Right? I mean, it's still considered a pesticide, certainly, but it's made from the neem tree, which comes from, I think, India, right?
Yeah.
But it probably, she's so smart because it sounds like rose slug. And the funny thing about rose slug is that you don't, I think they come out at night, basically, so you never really see them.
Right.
You know, so it really kind of consternates people. But neem should be an absolute effective product for ridding yourself of the rose slug.
But
problem.
Not to be confused with the slugs that eat hostas.
No, it's a different
kind of slug.
Animal altogether.
And for that, you use Sluggo.
Sluggo. You can use Sluggo, yeah.
It worked well.
That's a good product, too, isn't it?
I know, it is.
Absolutely. All right, here's a question for you, Mr. Bob.
Yes, ma'am.
Dear Homegrown, I have a clematis and something is chewing the bark. The vine will start to look good, putting off shoots and buds, then just die and wilt. I don't see any insects around it or on the leaves, but the bark near the ground looks something like something that's been skinning it off in places. What should I spray or do to stop this, or should I just dig it up?
No, don't dig it up. It sounds like clematis wilt,
mm-hmm.
or clematis wilt.
Yeah.
And I've had that off and on over the years, and clematis are amazingly resilient. They'll come back even years or two, year or two later. after you have this thing. But basically, you want to just cut it down to the ground.
Right.
And let's start over again.
And, you know, the whole skinning of the bark at the base,
yeah.
I'm not so sure that that's a pest, because don't your older clematis look
Yeah, they get a little, kind of, they exfoliate a little
they
bit.
They do.
Yeah.
But if you do feel like something's chewing on it, for sure, you can create like a little collar, if you will.
Yeah.
I mean, you can cut the bottom out of an old, like, little nursery pot, plastic pot, then cut the side and then create a little collar to sort of protect it that way. But cut, yeah, definitely cut it all the way to the ground first and then see what comes
and
back.
Wilt
do
has,
it now.
Yeah, wilt has a different look to it than, anyway, you can just see, it looks wilty.
Yeah.
To be scientific.
Yeah.
About
and it's not highly unusual for that to happen to a clematis either. All right, another question from Eleanor Hollihan, who, in fact, was the person that just asked the clematis question.
Yeah.
One other thing, I have pink knockout roses, but there are tiny green soft-bodied insects all over the new sprouts. She sprayed them, used 7-Dust, and just washed them off with the hose, but the next day they're back. The blooms are beautiful and dense. Any insight on how to handle this problem? Thank you. I enjoy your program very much, Eleanor.
Sounds more like aphids, doesn't it?
Sounds like aphids to me.
Yeah.
I would, let's see, again, you can use neem to control... aphids, and it might have a better, more residual effect than you know, what you've done so far. And just a note on aphids, it's been so hot, Bob, that, you know, when it gets hot, aphids have the ability to, like, give live birth.
I didn't know that.
And
I'm not sure I
it takes
know that.
Like 10 days for a brand new baby that's born to be able to, like, have babies again.
Holy
cow.
So
you can, like, have a bajillion aphids in a really short period of time. And they love the heat, so.
It's that time.
It is that time.
Okay.
All right, there you go.
If you have a neeming-full question for Bob or Janine, visit the Homegrown page at WFPL.org. Email us at homegrown@WFPL.org or call us at 502-814-8246. All right, Miss Wishy, show me the money.
Show you the money. I will. The Latin word of the week this week, numularius, numularium, numularia.
Yeah.
And have you ever seen that commercial where, I don't know what it's about, but they're like
money, I
numismatic
hope.
Or yeah. something like that. And it's like coins.
Coin collectors.
Yeah. So numularius means resembling a coin.
Yeah.
Usually applied to plants with small, almost circular leaves.
Almost circular, but not completely.
Yeah. How about that?
My money's the same way.
Okay, yeah.
My money's just not circular at all. Yeah. It goes out and never comes back.
Yeah, it does. You're right.
Where did it go?
All right. For example, Asclepias numularia.
The tufted milkweed.
Tufted milkweed. Almost circular foliage.
It is.
Yeah.
I just saw one this week.
Yeah. Croton numularifolius.
Is that the money plant?
Money croton.
Money croton, sorry.
Money croton.
Yeah.
Dioscorea numularia.
The yam.
The yam. The true yam, actually. Okay, you know what a sweet potato looks like.
I do.
Sweet potato vine, very sort of cut foliage, would you say? The true yam, Dioscorea, round like money foliage.
Yes, the yam.
That would be the way that you could truly tell the difference when they were growing in the ground.
Yemen.
Helianthemum numularium.
That's a lot of mums.
That's
the old sunrose.
Sunrose. Lysimachia numularia.
I love this plant, the Creeping Jenny.
Creeping Jenny.
I've got the gold one, Aurea.
Yep.
Great plant.
Pilea numularifolia.
Creeping Charlie.
Two, like Creeping Jenny and Creeping Charlie.
So if Creeping Jenny married Creeping Charlie,
they'd be really rich.
The money
and
might
you'd
come
like,
back.
Your yard would be covered in both.
Well, I want to go to that wedding.
All right. So if you see numularius, numularia, numularium, which is kind of hard to say, likely the plant is going to have almost circular leaves.
And you can take that to the bank, folks.
You can take that to the bank. All right, that ends another edition of Homegrown. Next week on the show, we're going to visit another fabulous garden, another local garden. This one belongs to Mr. Paul Jennings and his neighbors, in fact, because Paul also likes to do a little gardening for his neighbors.
Cannot help himself. Homegrown is produced by the fabulously wealthy Brad Yost in the studios of WFPL. I'm poor Bob Hill.
And I'm Janine Wishy. Join us next week for Homegrown on WFPL.